when the committee was to start today because of a dual agenda. That's the chair's fault, and I accept blame for that, but not too much. Anyway, we're going to start with a work session on House Bill 2305. Mr. Joseph, if you would walk us through the amendments that are necessary to get this bill moving along.
Sure, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. On House Bill 2305, you have a series of amendments in front of you. My understanding, the dash sevens are now the operable amendments. They incorporate all of the changes that the committee had previously requested, both the conceptual amendments and the amendments included in the dash fives, which were the last highest set that we were looking at. The dash sevens, the only differences between each of the amendments that you have in front of you is the issue with regard to fees that can be charged for labor incurred in copying. The dash seven amendments include a fee schedule which allows for a charge of $25 for 10 or fewer pages of written material and 25 cents a page thereafter.
All right, we're in work session. Senator Ringo.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash seven amendments to 2305.
Okay, Senator Ringo moves the adoption of the dash seven amendments or any seven amendments to House Bill 2305. Is there discussion?
I just don't seem to have those amendments, is all.
There you go.
Unless they're in another file.
Senator Ringo, you want to speak briefly to those?
Well, sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. In the last, I guess, four work days or so, I spent a lot of time discussing this issue with a lot of people. And this has been a big problem where the medical charges have really been excessive. And I sent a letter to the committee members yesterday outlining some specific examples that have come to light. For example, one person notified me that they've been charged $50 for one piece of paper. It goes on and on. And just from my personal law office, I went into my office on Sunday, and there was an example of, for 76 pages, the bill was $136. And that comes to not quite $2 a page. And it's just, that's far beyond the actual cost of copying. And in my discussions with the medical folks on this, I asked, what would you suggest for a fee schedule? And I was just, they would not give me a response. And I have crafted something that I think is fair. It's not meant it's meant to be an amount so that they can recover their reasonable costs, and yet they can't gouge. And so those are the numbers that seem reasonable to me. 25 cents a page is certainly well beyond the cost of operating a copier, and I think a significant labor cost would be included in that figure.
All right. Any additional discussion? Senator Ferriola.
Mr. Chairman, this is one of those instances where it's not the tall mountains or the distance of the journey that confounds the progress. It's the rock in your shoe. And this bill is a very complicated bill. It has interests that are wide-ranging. There's been huge compromise movement toward the middle on this bill. And to derail this process over an issue of copying costs, to me, would be irrational. So the amendments to this bill, I think, remove an impediment to moving it out of the committee and having the floor debate and then moving it on to what I believe will be a conference committee meeting. And maybe there's other bites of the apple people can take, but I certainly don't want to stand in the way of this bill moving out of the committee. So I'm fully prepared to support this. I think some of the arguments that Senator Ringo brings deserve better consideration. That in the spirit of compromise, we've moved a long way on this bill. I can't understand why we can't get a compromise on this issue, but we shouldn't impede the debate at this point. Let it move forward.
All right. Senator Walker.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. In federal bankruptcy court where I work, attorney law offices have to put forward a cost bill with the court, and the court would never approve that kind of copying charge Senator Ringo discussed this morning from a provider. I just think it's a reasonable issue to be discussing. We seem to be at an impasse with folks who disagree with this amendment. So I think Senator Ringo has a very valid point, and we should move this bill forward and see what happens.
All right. Further discussion? Any objections to the motion? No objection. Motion passes. Senator Ringo.
Mr. Chair, I move that we pass House Bill 2305 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Okay, Ringo now moves House Bill 2305 as amended to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Discussion?
Senator, Mr. Chairman, I just really appreciate the fact that for such a complicated issue, with so many interests and so many parties arranged around it, I appreciate the committee chair's handling and brokering the compromises and also the movement that I saw among many of the parties that tried to come together on this bill. So it's been complicated, and I've appreciated the fact that people have compromised.
It's amazing what can happen when the federal government shoves something in your ear. All right. Further discussion? Any objections? There are no objections. Motion passes. Senator Ringo, you will carry House Bill 2305.
Thank you,
on
Mr.
the
Chairman.
Floor. All right. Next bill, Mr. Joseph, work session 2306.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I believe the operable amendments for 2306 are the -A4 amendments. Again, they include the -A3s the committee adopted previously. They also include some conceptual amendments that the committee discussed.
Right. So the conceptual amendments we adopted and the A3 amendments are codified in the A4 amendments. Senator Walker.
Mr. Chair, I move the -A4 amendments to House Bill 2306.
Senator Walker moves the adoption of the A4 amendments to House Bill 2306. Is there discussion? Any objections? Hearing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chair, I would move House Bill 2306 as just amended to the House floor with a due pass recommendation, and I'm so glad we worked this one out.
Senate floor.
Excuse me.
Senator Walker moves House Bill 2306 as amended to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Any objections? Hearing none, so ordered. Senator Walker, would you be so kind as to carry that line piece of legislation?
Yes, absolutely.
Work session 2307. Mr.
Chairman, members of the committee, 2307 again has the -A4 amendments, which include the -A1 design stand, which the committee discussed previously, and which the committee wanted drafted. So
all right.
We're now up to the -A4s on 2307 as well.
All right. Senator Farioli.
Guess what's coming.
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Farioli moves the adoption of the A4 amendments to House Bill 2307. Is there any discussion?
Some
objections. Objection. Motion passes. Senator Farioli.
Move the bill to the floor with the due pass recommendation. As amended.
Senator Farioli. Can't talk anymore. It's pepperoni and...
ravioli, pepperoni, all
whatever. Anyway, Senator Farioli moves House Bill 2307 as amended by the A4 amendments to the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Any objections? Hearing none, so ordered. Senator Farioli.
Honored to do so.
Thank you, Chair. So kind. House Bill 2309.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, House Bill 2309 is ready to go, has no amendment.
All right.
Believe it or not.
Senator Walker, would you do me the courtesy?
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2309 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Okay. Senator Walker moves House Bill 2309, unamended, to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Any objections? Hearing none, so ordered. And I will carry that bill. All right. God bless you all. Have a nice day.
Mr. Chairman, I can oral surgery that wasn't this painful.
All right.
Forward will
be. Senator
I think they have another bias.
I'm going to look to call his office because I've got Senator Harper's office here. Are you on here? 459?
No, I'm not.
459. Why don't we start with Senator Bill?
Because otherwise we can going to give us the press release about the self-serving.
What do we have? What are we doing?
may be coming anyway. You know what I decided?
Are we still on there?
Yeah, I think so.
We are.
We're going to
see if there is or maybe we can go on. I'll just see right up there.
All right, we're going to go on to continuation of public hearing on Senate Bill 732. Hopefully we can whip through this. Susan Russell, you're first up.
And Mr. Chairman, can I just kind of give a...
Yes, absolutely. Go ahead.
Let me just give a background. Mr. Chairman, we had a hearing on 732 on a few days ago on March 31st. As you may or may recall, Senate Bill 32 is a bill that deals with impounding upon conviction for driving while suspended. Hopefully you have those in your packet. I spoke with the proponents of the bill. I believe they spoke on the 31st, Bruce Pratt and Mrs. Pratt. I'm sorry, I'm blanking. Diane, I think. Excuse me, Ann Pratt. Sorry, Ann. Yeah, my apologies. Ann and Bruce testified on this bill. Lieutenant Ed Stallard from Lincoln County Sheriff's Office testified on this bill. At that time, I believe he was against the bill. And the reason was, I believe, as currently written, this would deal with a person who is convicted of a driving while suspended offense. I spoke with those people in my office and realized that I think that the goal was to do this upon arrest or citation, meaning when a person is pulled over and an officer finds that the officer has probable cause to believe that he or she was driving while suspended, then the impound would take place. That is currently what is done by several cities. Portland, for example, has a local city ordinance that allows impound for driving uninsured, for driving while suspended. And as you know, Mr. Chairman, the Portland Police Department is under a general order to do so. So this would be more in line with that impound upon arrest or citation. I ask that the -2 amendments be drafted. And if you have those, I will say this. They need work. They're not quite where I wanted them to be. But if you look at Section 3 of the -2 amendments, this would be the idea, I think, that the Pratts wanted to go towards. And the idea is we would be changing the focus from the current bill, 732, would amends a section of law that allows a court, not mandatory but discretionary, allows a court to impound a car for up to a year on any kind of driving while suspended. This -2 amendment, the Section 3, would make mandatory impound for those suspensions that are under 811-182. And these are the criminal suspensions. For example, for if you are suspended for committing a felony of manslaughter, homicide, if you are suspended for recklessly endangering another person in a car, if you're suspended for perjury to the Department of Transportation, if you're suspended for refusing to take a breath test, if you're suspended for a failure to perform the duties of a driver, hit and run, if you're suspended for reckless driving. So that would be the mandatory suspension, and it would also be a mandatory suspension upon arrest for DUI. And then in subsection 2 of Section 3, the vehicle would be impounded for 30 days. This is the language that was in the bill originally. If it's the person's first, and it says arrest, but the concept, Mr. Chairman, is that if the suspension would be for 30 days if they have no prior convictions for driving while suspended, and for 60 days if they have a prior conviction for what they've been pulled over for. So it would be either suspension or DUI. So that's what I worked on with the proponents between the 31st and now.
Right. Great. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Go ahead, Senator Rigo.
Thank you. I just wanted to ask one question.
Sure.
I think you said this, Craig, but this still contemplates that the impoundment would occur without a conviction upon the stop.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Ringo, that is correct. That is, it is the current law of 809.720 would allow for that, allows an officer to impound a vehicle upon arrest. Also, as I said, many city ordinances allow that. The change here would be that when your car gets impounded for an arrest, you can go back and get it, usually within a day or two. If the person entitled to possession of it goes back and is not intoxicated and has a valid driver's license, they can go get the car, or they can have someone else do it.
So then they can demonstrate that they do have insurance, they do have a license.
If you look at that's correct. I want to, Mr. Chairman, I want to make sure, and Senator Ring, I want to make sure that I'm saying that correctly. But in practice, and practically, if say you and your wife own a car and you get pulled over for DUI, this is a hypothetical. then you, your wife could go get the car the next day or 2 days later if she's able to pay for the storage charges. And so this would change it so it would be 30 days. You can't get that car for 30 days. And incidentally, you would be paying for storage because the way this usually works is a municipality, say the agency that pulled you over, would contract with a tow company. So that tow company would be holding that car. Now, does that answer your question?
Yeah. Well, Mr. Chairwoman, are there some due process questions, though, whether you're depriving somebody of their property without?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Ringo, there is a statute that gives a hearing in 809.716. You can request a hearing before a judge if you believe that there was no validity to the impoundment. So say you believe that there was maybe your brother used your ID and got suspended under your name, you can do a hearing. A request would be made within five calendar days to do so.
Okay. Thank you.
All right.
Mr. Chairman, I think Senator Ringo would obviously not be subject to such an arrest because he would simply claim the diplomatic immunity.
Oh, that's right.
Oh, I wouldn't. I would pay my dues.
That would be a political football. Yeah, not that that's ever happened before.
Ambassador Ringo.
All right. This is degrading itself, integrating, falling down. Okay. Let's see. Let's get back to the Susan Russell. If you want to come up, I mean, you're taking Kelly Sky's place, right? Because you guys like tag team me on the defense side, right?
Susan Russell on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, and we're here to speak in opposition of Senate Bill 732. It's our position that we believe that the court should maintain discretion, which they currently have, in determining whether to impound a vehicle. I guess in terms of where we are with the amendments, I'm a bit confused because of the drafting, and I've spoken with counsel. As originally drafted, it's my understanding that this provision would apply both to suspensions that were the result of criminal convictions and to suspensions that were the result of non-criminal convictions, and that the -2 amendments seek to limit the impoundment on driving while suspended to cases where the suspension was the result of criminal convictions. I don't think that the amendments completely do that. There are some errors, and I've spoken to committee counsel with that about that issue.
Let me ask you a question. If they actually got those wired together that way, would you support the bill?
We would not. Mr. Chair, we continue to believe that the court should have discretion, and there are sort of two concerns, if I can just be brief about those. The first is that in terms of suspensions, there are a number of suspensions that counsel has already outlined that involve, driving misbehavior, and some of it very aggravated driving, criminal conduct arising from use of a vehicle. This provision, 811.182, which is the provision that provides or allows suspension as a result of a criminal conviction, also applies to any, it applies to felonies as well. And for example, I'll give one. In possession of a controlled substance, the courts are mandated to suspend a license. And that is often done even when a vehicle is not involved. So, for example, somebody is convicted of possession of a controlled substance and the court suspends their license. And so there's no connection between their conduct and any driving behavior. The crime didn't involve a driving crime. And so we believe that in addition to the judges generally being able to maintain discretion and that they do exercise their discretion of impoundment appropriately, that there are crimes that would fall within this suspension provision that don't even involve driving behavior. We also have concerns, as Senator Ringo has tagged them, about due process. While there is the ability to request a hearing, that request has to be made within 5 days. And I'm not sure, I'll defer to counsel in terms of when the hearing has to be set from the original request. But I don't think that requesting a hearing is really going to solve the problem, because I believe by the time the hearing would be requested and heard, at least part of this time for the impoundment would have already gone.
Well, but Susan, can't the police already seize as evidence?
Mr. Chair, I believe so.
And hold it in perpetuity, can't they? I mean, until a court orders them to release it. But I've done that as a homicide investigator. I've held onto a vehicle as evidence, and there's nothing other than the court's, telling me I have to release it.
And Mr. Chair, I think that's correct. And we're talking about two different things. One is in terms of this impoundment statute, there are different provisions that apply.
Right.
And I do agree. I believe that when we're talking about this impoundment, that you're correct. The officers have a huge amount of discretion in impounding vehicles when they're, let's say, that a manslaughter is
really. Yeah, but the DUII.
And a DUII.
Instrumentality of the crime. It's evidence.
Correct, Mr. Chair. And I think the difference is that we have discretion at present that somebody is exercising. And this bill would take discretion away from police officers who can assess whether a vehicle ought to be
right.
impounded under the circumstances, or the courts having discretion to determine whether a vehicle ought to.
But you do agree with the objective of keeping the person who has a DUII problem from getting back in a car and driving again. I assume you agree with that.
Mr. Chair, of course we do.
Right.
It's a concern. It's a number of issues in this bill with impoundment. I don't think that this is really the answer. It's impounding a vehicle in dealing with people that are driving while suspended
right.
that are really sort of the habitual offenders that I think are probably the people that the proponents are most concerned. It doesn't. There are other vehicles. I mean, this is sort of approaching one aspect of it.
That's why I support the Code of Hammurabi for these guys. Just whack their hands off.
Yeah.
Can't drive. Need a prosthetic device to drive the car. Okay, Senator Ringo.
Thank you. Good morning, Susan. The proponents of this bill are trying to deal with these people that get nailed for driving while suspended and just keep on driving while suspended, and the current system seems unable to deal with that. We're not even prosecuting people who commit non-person crimes these days. So, to me, there's a big problem out there, and this is a step in the right direction. I'm just wondering, if you don't think this is the right answer, what is the right answer?
Mr. Chair, Senator Ringo, I think perhaps. I mean, there are a number of different ways to approach. One would be enhancing penalties, when we're talking about the sort of very aggravated driving while suspended that have resulted from sort of serious criminal conduct, and the problem with driving suspended, it can result from a whole number of different things from criminal to non-criminal. And there really are, and I think the proponents have come here with them. I wasn't present, but I understand with, some really heartbreaking examples of suspensions that resulted from incredibly aggravated and damaging behavior. And I think that our concern here is that this may, it's very hard in drafting a bill to limit it to those circumstances, and that this bill, while addressing some of those cases, will also address a lot of other cases that are less aggravating and present less of a risk. And of course, the problem in trying to sort of target that group is that while one vehicle may be impounded and an individual is driving while suspended, there may be other vehicles that that individual has access to. So I totally agree with your opinion, Senator, and with the proponents that this is a very difficult issue to solve.
Right. Thank you, Senator Farrell.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a comment. I think they failed to act to remove this instrumentality after a second violation, which is essentially what we're talking about here, is to put the state in the role of an enabler. You know, we're enabling criminal behavior because we're not taking away the means of the crime, which is driving while suspended. I just, you know, if there's a due process question or a question of the constitutionality, there's a place where the individual can go argue that case, and if somebody wants to take it to a court proceeding and test the issue, let the car stay parked while they have the argument.
All right. Thank you very much. Susan, thank you.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Mr. Curtis, Kirk Curtis, or I don't know what your rank is. Are you like a captain or something? Huh? Sergeant? You work for a living. I like that.
Good morning. My name is Kirk Curtis, and I'm a sergeant with the Oregon State Police, assigned to the Patrol Services Division of our general headquarters. I'm here today on Senate Bill 732. Originally, with the original bill, we came up as a neutral position. There would be a fiscal impact with regards to the implementation upon conviction. In other words, having to have someone go out, find the vehicle, do the immobilization devices, if that was what was dictated by the court, and then coming back at the end of the suspension period, collecting the fees that were due, and then removing the boot or the immobilization device. We did see this, though, that basically if our rental fee as per the bill and our administrative fee was $350 apiece based on the number of arrests that we made. In the year 2001, the Oregon State Police arrested 11,893 people for driving while suspended. Basically, I computed that out, and it came out to a fiscal of basically 26 FTE officer time for the installation and removal of the boots, and seven professional staff, which would be clerical support for paperwork, letters, whatever was necessary on the original bill. We came out with basically a fiscal of about $5.6 million, but with that $350 collection, based on that, it would be a self-sufficient. With a 70% collection, we came up with, we'd collect back $5,800, or $5.8 million, and with 100% collection on all of the immobilizations, be $8.3 million if we use the same fee for everybody as to the rental administrative fee. So it could be a bill that would be self-sufficient or self-supporting for agencies or entities with the administrative fee and rental fee that was charged. But there would be the initial startup cost to make the implementation of the bill. I just had a chance to read the Dash 2 amendments. I have some real concerns. I understand the concerns expressed at the committee last time with regards to, well, location of the vehicle after, the fact that the person has access to it until the court made some sort of adjudication, maybe 6 months, a year, year and a half, depending on how far down the road they decided to delay the court action, allowing the people to have access and use of the vehicle. Currently, under 809.720, the law allows that police agencies may impound a vehicle for driving while suspended, no insurance, no operator's license, or driving under the influence. Originally, when that was the Senate Bill 780, originally several sessions ago, that tacked it onto the insurance statute that originally said that we could tow for no insurance and impound the vehicle until the person showed proof of insurance. Under Senate Bill 780, I believe it was two sessions ago, we added the fact for driving while suspended, no ops license, and driving under the influence. And what the bill basically says, or the law says, is that we can impound the vehicle. The owner of the vehicle or the person can come down and show that they have current insurance, they've got a valid driver's license, they're the registered owner of the vehicle, and they can pay an administrative fee to the agency and pick up their vehicle. They would then go to the tow yard and make arrangements to pay for the impoundment or the towing cost of the vehicle and receive their vehicle that way. The wording shall in the original bill was one of the contested things that agencies had a problem with. Currently, with our reductions in staffing and professional staff to do the clerical work and support work, we have suspended doing the impoundment tows as an agency because we just don't have the clerical time and support to be able to do that.
Hang on, what did you just say?
With our current reduction...
The law says you shall and you're not shall.
You may.
Oh.
The law currently says may.
May.
Rather than shall.
What was the shall thing?
The shall was the original wording in the law.
Okay,
when it was,
so why are we talking about that?
Seven. Okay. Basically, at that point, it put a mandate that if a person was arrested for driving under the influence, no ops license, or whatever the charge was, the agency had to take the vehicle into custody, as which put an additional burden on the agency. There are some areas that have the staffing and support, at least as an agency that we have, that can handle doing the additional paperwork. They have enough staff, they have enough officers that are able to handle this additional burden. We have other areas in the state where basically the clerical staff may be part-time or volunteer staff that comes into the office, and the consistency of being able to process the paperwork and to handle the tow situation is not available in those areas. Secondly, 809.720 makes a requirement that the agency send a letter out to all parties of interest in the vehicle within 48 hours after the vehicle is seized. The person has 5 days then from the postmark date of the letter to request a hearing, and the hearing has to be set up within 4 days, and that's an administrative hearing before an administrative law judge rather than a court proceeding. They can appeal that then. If the hearing is adverse to them, they can appeal it to a circuit court or, the Court of Appeals. So it's an administrative hearing to begin with, and then it's a Court of Appeals if they contest the ruling of the administrative law judge. The Dash 2 amendments with Shell, we have some problems with that because of the infrastructure. If we had a larger staff as an agency to do that, we might be able to work that out or make that work. The other thing that I have a concern with is the seizure for such a long period of time. Of the vehicle 30 days, 60 days, and then it goes to a judicial proceeding, and the person by some chance is found not guilty of the particular incident where the vehicle is seized. Then it comes back that the agency involved is more than likely going to have several financial costs to them because of the fact that they're going to have to pay for the tow, any fees that were incurred, any other expenses the person can come up with that they may have lost because of not being able to drive or their spouse not being able to drive.
Well, but the arrest is based on probable cause, correct?
Yes, sir.
That doesn't mean you're financially liable. And they're going to sue you and win first.
I would have to research that area to find out further on that, sir.
Well, I mean, the seizure and arrest is based on probable cause, which is something less than proof beyond a reasonable doubt. So if found not guilty, that doesn't mean that all of a sudden the state's now liable for their cause. You just make sure that the officers are well trained and the base probable cause. We've articulated that. That's the defense. Anyway, I'm not a civil lawyer. I'm just a down the
Street. That's why I don't dabble in that or go into those areas because I'm that's, not.
But
not
see, I have the freedom of being a chair. I can mouth off like this. It's kind of fun, actually. I kind of enjoy that.
I appreciate your comments.
All right,
sir.
Senator Ringo.
Thank you. To me, there's a lot of uncertainty as to how this pencils out financially, and that really is the crux of this. Because agencies do have the discretion to do this, and my guess is they don't because it does not pencil out. Is that accurate?
And Chairman, as Senator Ringo, at this time, we had several offices that were able to do this, the impoundments of vehicles based on the current law of 809.720.
Okay, just like several offices of the state police.
Yes, sir.
And where were those offices located?
Portland, Springfield, Albany, basically the Willamette Valley area where we had larger contingencies and larger support staff.
Okay, so go ahead then.
Eastern Oregon, it was intermixed with the availability of whether they could do this. And with the basic reductions, we've had to pull that as one of our programs that we were doing in all offices because of the cutback, the time. Not only do they have the office time, but we also have support time up at headquarters with regards to arranging for the administrative hearings for these procedures, handling all the paperwork, documentation, and getting all the documentation sent back. Since it's such a quick turnaround under the current law, We in turn have to send any discovery out by overnight delivery to the person involved or requesting the hearing so that they have full discovery on what we're presenting to the hearings officer.
Okay. Mr. Chair?
Yes.
But even when you take into account the cost of holding the hearings and those administrative costs, can this be self-financing in certain areas, just say Portland or Albany?
Chair Menas, Senator Ringo, I believe that it could be. Originally, when this law went into effect, we made a promise at the table to the legislature at that time that we would charge as an agency only for the administrative cost and not the officer-involved time.
I see.
We believe that some agencies may be charging for officer time because they're right now we're basically charging $25 for administrative time, and that's about the best that we can calculate with administrative or support personnel to be able to handle these things for each one. We know of some agencies that are over $100 for that administrative fee, so I don't know what is all entailed in their administrative cost, but we made a promise that we wouldn't charge for officer time, the 3 or 4 hours it takes him to prosecute the drunk driver, the other time that's involved in these instances for violating the officer's part.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, sir.
The 3 or 4 times to prosecute the drunk driver, I mean, this isn't about prosecuting drunk drivers, it's about keeping their vehicles. We'd be prosecuting them anyway, correct?
Chairman and Senator Ringo, yes, we would. The courts would have be called upon to do the prosecution.
So that shouldn't be considered as the cost of this bill. I mean, are we missing? Am I missing something?
Senator Menas, Chair Ringo, I think we may have miscommunicated there on that, because the cost that we're talking about is basically the administrative cost for processing the particular impoundment of the vehicle.
The impoundment.
Right.
Okay.
Not any court cost or anything like that that may be incurred by the agency, such as the officer time or this type of thing.
Okay.
I mean, one solution would be just flatten the agency and do away with about half the lieutenants, captains, and ranking officers, and, you know, to just push memos back and forth amongst themselves and actually put some patrol people in these functions. You don't have to comment on that. I wouldn't recommend it. You do.
Thank you, Chair Menas.
Thank you. I can say that because I've never seen the superintendent in the several years he's been the superintendent. In any event, thank you very much. One more.
So, you think this could pencil out in a populated area like Portland? What do you have? Do you think it could pencil out, say, over the mountains on the east side? Is it more problematic?
Chair Menas, Senator Ringo, I have to look at it in several areas. With regards, the Portland area may have a larger infrastructure where this would work for them because of the number of tow companies they have up there that have the lot and slot space available to handle these things. If it were mandatory, we may be putting an undue burden on the mom-and-pop gas station in eastern Oregon that has a tow service to assist a section of highway, and they're the only ones out there for 150 miles. And they may have storage capacity for one or two or three vehicles at the most. And then we're putting a 30-day or larger time that they have to hold those vehicles. The security factor for vehicles and other things, and I don't want to go into Mr. Elkins' area. But,
how many people have to get killed by drunk drivers before we actually do something?
Mm-hmm. Well, that's true.
I mean, I can find $1.5 million by just whacking the academy that you guys go through and blending you in with the basic DPSST program. So, you know, I appreciate what you do, and I appreciate what you're giving to the committee, but I think this is a very important issue, and I think obfuscating it by, you know, fiscal issues, et cetera, I really don't even want to hear it. I think it's a priority that your agency should be engaged in. That's my opinion.
Chair Menas, members of the committee, I want to let you know that we do have a high priority for drunk drivers, removal from the roadway, driving while suspended, other issues that are before the committee here on this bill. It is a major concern to the agency. Our officers basically arrest around 100 drunk drivers a week. I mean, the impetus of needing something like this is out there. It's just the basic infrastructure that I have to bring to your attention, the fact that can we do this in an economical way that's available for everybody to be able to do it,
right,
and to set this up. And I think that's the major consideration that's before the committee, is the bill basically for what it's trying to do, I can't dispute, trying to get the drunk driver and suspended driver off the road.
Right.
But it's the infrastructure and setup of how this can work and then be equitable all the way across the board is the question you have.
All right. Appreciate that. I had a bunch of sheriffs tell me one time that they couldn't investigate child sexual abuse cases because they didn't know how to do it. they now are required to do it. Anyway, Senator Fairley.
Mr. Chairman, I am sensitive to the issue of the inconvenience and the expense and the administrative nightmare. It's going to be a lot of problems and overhead. So. But it just simply cannot compare with the allowing folks that are essentially scofflaws to continue to drive while suspended. And the idea that communities at this point are helpless to try and break that cycle without some kind of a new tool. And this, I can't imagine in rural communities that don't have the infrastructure that the cities do. I can't imagine that the community collectively or even citizens individually wouldn't do all they could to take the ability to continue to reoffend and reoffend away from people. And if inconveniencing the car owner or inconveniencing the tow lot owner is the price, then we'll have to live with the inconvenience. And just the idea of the helplessness of the community, when people read about 6 and 7 and 8 times people pulled over and cited for driving while suspended or no license or no insurance or, you know, all the things that happen. Almost in every case where we see some serious victimization, there's been a pattern of reckless irresponsibility. And I don't know how you can break that other than just put people on their feet for a couple of months. You know, and maybe they have multiple vehicles, but if they reoffend, you know, I can see situations where eventually several automobiles and vehicles by the same individuals are at various storage places across the state of Oregon. So be it.
All right. Thank you, Kurt. You've been very helpful. I appreciate the dialogue back and forth. You see the superintendent around, say hi to him.
I'll do it. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. Mr. Elkins, quickly if you can.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Al Elkins. I've got a couple hats on today. First of all, I'm representing the Car Rental and Truck Leasing Association of Oregon. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I wrote this testimony in relation to the original bill and the part upon conviction. Our concern is that we rent cars to someone that is convicted or cited, and we're not able to get our vehicle back in a timely manner for car rental folks. So I'm not an attorney, but I've tried to act like one in this testimony, I believe. And
but you're not practicing law, correct?
Right, and I'm not an attorney. And I have put together a similar... we're thinking along the lines of a certificate of non-liability, which is used for photo radar, if we could, in effect, use something like that system for car rental companies in relation to this bill. I don't know how that fits. I've included the statute and the citing of the statute. Basically, it allows us to fill out a form that says we're a rental company and this person was driving the car and they were renting the car from us. And we're not the owner of the vehicle. And we do that in photo red light. And I've seen similar certificates that have come to my house when my daughter is driving our vehicle for photo red light. And it's got her picture and all that. And I sign her certificate. It says we weren't driving the car, she was. So if we could look at incorporating something like that in the language of the bill, it would be helpful.
All right. Senator Walker, do you have a comment here?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Elkins, did you say you've received several of those at your
house? I have four daughters.
Oh, you poor man.
Yeah.
I was thinking also, I saw Mr. Landauer in the back, and you know, the city of Portland just loves this photo red light stuff. So does the city of Beaverton. I hate it. But perhaps they might be able to enlighten.
He's going to come up next.
A little bit more about the certificate you're talking about.
Thank you. That concludes my testimony.
Thank you, Al.
You're welcome.
This product's not done yet, obviously. Senator Ringo.
Thank you. When you get a car at a rental car agency, I haven't rented a car in a while, but you show them your license, you show them proof of insurance. Do they check to make sure that your
your license is current and not suspended? Do they do that check at all?
I don't believe there's a mechanism, Mr. Chair, Senator Rigo. I don't believe there's a mechanism for them to check with the DMV. Are you talking about?
Yeah.
I don't believe that mechanism is in place.
So
I don't know that.
So your concern is people can be showing licenses and the rental car company won't know that that's a suspended license.
Right. It might be a license that is not valid for that person, but has been tampered with or something of that nature.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks so much.
Mr. Chair, I have a testimony here from Bob Russell, Oregon Trucking Association. I'll hand out for the record.
All right. Thank you.
And I'm also here if you need any tow truck question answers. Tow truck question answers, I'll be in the audience in case you need that.
Do they like to tow things?
Mr. Chair, yes, they do.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Bill Joseph wants to know what the little tires are in the back, but I can tell him. That's when they load it on a little dolly thing. Those are the dolly tires. All right, Ms. Monson and Mr. Landauer. Mr. Landauer, I assume that you've researched this entire subject and are fully competent in all areas, given your stellar appearance in the General Government Committee yesterday afternoon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for reminding me. Mark Landauer with the Office of Government Relations. Just for the record, I know very little about land use, obviously, Mr. Chairman, and just didn't want to see myself skinned alive before that committee. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, again, Mark Landauer with the Office of Government Relations. The City of Portland has several concerns, and I'm going to be very general here. I think some of the concerns were already expressed by Sergeant Curtis. What I would tell the committee is the City of Portland is already what we think sort of meeting to some extent the intent with this bill. We are impounding for DWS. We are impounding for DWI, a lewd driving without proof of financial responsibility. We're impounding people who elude. We're impounding Johns. We're impounding various drug infractions, whatnot. So we do have a very aggressive city ordinance dealing with impoundment. The problem that this bill presents is, frankly, the 30-day impoundment or the 60-day impoundment. We're concerned that, frankly, one, we don't necessarily, the city's tow lot doesn't have the capacity to take on the additional volume that this bill requires. Secondly, we are hopeful that the towers would have that capacity, but again, the numbers are pretty substantial, what we're talking about here, and I am working on trying to get solid numbers last year on the number of people who would be captured by this bill, and frankly, and I apologize, I do not have solid numbers at this time. With that, I'll end my comments, but I think to some degree we are meeting the intent of what the Pratts are trying to accomplish here. We're just not impounding for the length of time that they're requesting. I would also just mention to you that in order for an owner of a vehicle to get that vehicle released, they must pay the administrative fee. It runs anywhere from $150 to $250. They have to pay the storage. They have to show proof of financial responsibility that they have a valid driver's license and that they own the vehicle. With that, I end my comments.
Senator Ringo, Senator Walker, whoever else.
Your current period of impoundment is significantly less than 30 days.
Indeed.
And does Portland make money or lose money on this program?
I believe that we probably lose a little bit of money, and we've made that public policy choice because we want these vehicles off the road immediately until these people can be sober. But this is where we lose the money. It's where the people walk away from the vehicle.
Yeah,
okay.
So here we go. Can you get? Do you have that data available?
I can certainly see if we can get that for you. Absolutely.
Thank you. I mean, I would be very interested in seeing how it does pencil out for Portland.
Sure.
And how often it is that people walk away from a vehicle, and that Portland is left holding the bag on a vehicle that is
a liability as opposed to an asset.
Indeed. You know, there are some instances, of course, where the towers will take it to their own tow lot. And then, you know, if the person doesn't show up or whatnot, they can file a lien on the vehicle, take possession of the vehicle, sell it, scrap it, whatnot. And Mr. Elkins, as the lobbyist for the towers, said that they support it. Obviously, this will mean a great deal more business to them. But with that, I certainly will track down the numbers for you.
Well, Mr. Chair, does Portland tow more of the vehicles to city-owned lots or private lots?
Again, Chairman or Senator Ringo, I apologize. I don't have the numbers on that, and again, we are working on that.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Senator Walker, did you have something to say?
Yes, I do. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Landauer, I was writing down as quickly as you were saying it. When you release the vehicle, you require payment of the administrative fees, storage fees, and proof of license. But you didn't mention proof of insurance.
No, I did. Proof of financial responsibility as well as proof of ownership.
Well, what's proof of financial responsibility?
That is insurance.
Oh, okay.
Clearly, you haven't been stopped and asked that question.
No,
all right.
I haven't.
Excellent.
And then my next question is, Mr. Elkins talked about the certificate of non-liability for car rental companies under your infamous photo red light program. So would you please tell me a little bit about that, and could that be used in this instance?
Well, the rental car industry and the city have had a number of interesting conversations over the years, I should say, about, for example, forfeiture. As you may recall, I believe it was in the 99 session, the legislature authorized local governments to forfeit upon third conviction of DUI within a 3-year period. The rental car industries have had, and the city of Portland, I should say, also has had an aggressive forfeiture, civil forfeiture ordinance in the past. The certificate of, and if you could repeat the what?
Certificate of non-liability is what he called it.
Senator, I would have to go back and refamiliarize myself with that, because, again, that was a subject that was discussed a couple of years ago, and I just don't want to mischaracterize that. But I believe what the intent of that was is for rental cars to be able to quickly get back their vehicle if somebody who has rented their vehicle is pulled over for DWI or something of that nature, and it wouldn't be put into the process for forfeiture. I believe that they are required, however, to pay the administrative costs associated with the siting and the impound and towing. But that you know, don't etch that in stone, please. I would, again, have to go back and double-check on that.
Well, Mr. Chair, I'll just continue. Mr. Landauer, if this bill continues to move forward, I'd ask you to work with Mr. Elkins on that issue and make sure that we get that as part of this bill.
Chairman and Senator Walker, I think we've come to a general agreement on these issues, and we generally see eye to eye with the concerns of the rental car industry in this subject area.
And I would hope that if this bill became law, we wouldn't start seeing a lot of people going out and getting a rental car when they knew they were going out on a night on the town and going to drive home drunk. I don't know that people think that far ahead, but you never know. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Christy, welcome back to the judiciary. You've been for a long time.
Welcome back, Chair Minnis, members of the committee. My name is Christy Munson with the League of Oregon Cities. For the record, thank you for the welcome. We too have some concerns, too general and too specific, regarding this bill. We'll start with the general. We just would just like the committee to know that the collections rate on things like this, I think a 70% collection rate would be very optimistic. I don't have the collection rate numbers. We do have that data out in the field with our cities, and we're trying to get that now. Frankly, several of our cities don't impound right now, so it would be very difficult for them to know what the collection rate is. The second general concern I have is this bill requires an impoundment. Several of our cities don't have the capacity to compound impound cars, and or the structure set up to impound cars. Of course, before law, we'd have to find that. And again, if the financial, if the fiscals would turn out to be high enough, it may trigger unfunded mandate. So I just wanted the committee to be aware of that. In some cities, it may trigger unfunded mandate. Having said that, you know, cities, we are where people live, and we are very concerned about public safety and people using cars as instrumentalities. I mean, we don't want this to happen. We'd like to work with the proponents to find some maybe non-legislative ways to inform cities on how they can prevent these kind of accidents from occurring. The two specific concerns I have, in Section 3 in the Dash 2 amendments, and I may be wrong about this, but my reading of the bill, the Dash 2 amendments only deal with impoundments. However, the entire statute deals with immobilization. And the Dash 2 amendments, as I read them, and I completely reserve the right to be wrong, only deal with impoundments. I'm wondering why they didn't also deal with immobilization, which may or may not be a more fiscally responsible method for us. But I'd like to have that conversation with the proponents. And lastly, my last specific concern is a legal concern. Some of our city attorneys have mentioned that there may be some kind of due process problem with mandating a 30 to 60 day impoundment upon arrest and not conviction. We haven't fleshed that legal argument out entirely, but they are nervous about that, and I can get more information on that as we proceed.
All right.
Mr. Chairman, I just wanted to clarify from Ms. Munson. The Dash 2 amendments, they are, again, we need to work on them, and they are confusing, relate to 809.720, which is the impounding by the officer upon arrest or citation. 809.700, which is the original bill, is the one that relates to a conviction, and that contemplates after a person is convicted, someone going and either impounding, taking it, or immobilizing it. So that's why the immobilization is not in the Dash 2 amendments.
Can I ask a clarifying question?
Of course, absolutely.
That's an odd thing to ask from the side of the table. Craig, are you saying that the impoundment provision only is triggered upon conviction?
Mr. Chairman, no, I'm not. I'm saying that 809.720, statute that relates to impound upon arrest by an officer, only contemplates impound because they're taking that car. And so they wouldn't just put a boot on it and leave it in the middle of the road.
All right. I love you, lawyers. It's great. Oh, another one. Okay, Senator Ringo, your answer.
I'm glad you like lawyers.
I do. I love them.
Thank you.
Great when you need them.
You said the collection rate is 70%. What does that mean? What's a collection rate?
Chairman, as Senator Ringo, I had heard in previous testimony that they were basing their fiscals upon a possible 70% collection rate. My testimony was just, I think that would be a little optimistic. I don't know what the collection rate is now. Basing collection rates from our court collections on court fines and fees, not on impoundments, a 70% number sounds a little optimistic to me.
But I just want to know what you mean when you say collection rate. I think is what you mean is that the storage costs, the towing, the administration, all those, you know, let's just say for a certain vehicle it added up to $400. On average, you would a collection rate of 70% means you get 70% of that $400.
If the collection rate were 70%, that was the logic I was using on using that. And I think it's important for the committee to know that the charges could be significant in storing a vehicle for 30 to 60 days.
It seems to me that you would have a higher collection rate, though, because at least for a lot of vehicles are going to have value. So whereas for a regular court fine, you don't have some collateral sitting there somewhere.
Chairman, Senator Ringo, that's correct. Often a lot of the vehicles don't have as much value as you might think. And the collection rate for storage fees per day, from dealing my knowledge from another bill, can be so significant as to reach to the $1,000.
Yes. Okay.
And I know from having just sold my car, it didn't reach that.
Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you. This has been stimulating. We'll be back on this at some future date. So we'll close the public hearing. Thank God on Senate Bill 732. And now we're going to go back to. Okay, I think actually I'm going to go to 459. Public hearing on Senate Bill 459. Okay, I'm going to put a few people in. Jeffrey Wimmer, are you going to introduce this for Senator Harper or who's? Okay, why don't you do that? And I think I've got Senator Fisher, if he wants to, if he's hearing this, we can get Trixie up here. And if I could get the committee's cooperation here today to bleed over just a little bit, if I can, unless we run into a brick wall. 10:15. That's sweet of you, thank you. All right. Mr. Wimmer.
Hi, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm here for Senator Harper. He requests that I express in the strongest words his support for Senate Bill 459. I'd like to read from a letter from Representative Shetterly. It says, this change would provide greater protection for a hearing officer's finding of fact. Conversely, it would make it more difficult for an agency to change the findings of fact to support a particular desired outcome. That's the crux of this issue. We're talking about changing facts and retaining the authority for agencies to do what they like in spite of the facts. Senate Bill 459 would restrict an agency's capacity to change those facts after a hearing officer had ruled. Senate Bill 459 is a step forward in restoring the public trust in Oregon, and it addresses the current problem we have where agencies can pick and choose facts and that blind in the face of logic. Please, in your consideration of this bill, remember that just because it's good for an agency or because an agency wants it doesn't make it necessarily good for the public, nor does it make it justice. Please support Senate Bill 459 and our ongoing search for truth and justice, and please lend this bill your vote.
All right. Thank you very much. Now, we've got a whole host of people again. And I think what we're going to do, Mr. Counsel, would you explain 459 to us in terms of this general construct?
Sure. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Senate Bill 459 is intended to, at this point, you should look at the amendments, which I think
choose
now. It's essentially changing the. If you look at the very bottom of page 1 on line 23, it's changing the evidentiary standard from a preponderance of the evidence to substantial evidence. A preponderance of the evidence is what we're all used to in a civil case, that the party making claim has to prove their case by a preponderance of the evidence. That different than clear and convincing, which is slightly higher, or beyond a reasonable doubt, which is the highest. Substantial evidence is the normal burden of proof, as it's called, when administrative decisions are being reviewed, and it just means that the administrative decision has to be reviewed to determine whether there is substantial evidence in the record to support the decision.
So this does not prevent the agency or board from overturning the decision of the administrative law judge. It just raises the
it changes the bar, and as long as there's substantial evidence in the record, I would say it actually lowers the bar slightly, because it's no longer a preponderance of the evidence. It's now substantial, which is, in land use cases, that's often the standard that's being looked at. 459 is now quite different
under the Dash 2 amendments than what you would be looking at under the bill itself or even the Dash 1 amendments.
All right.
And I've asked Representative Shetterly to come up and speak to the Dash 2s because it's my understanding that he's been working with the proponents to have this bill correspond with the other bill we'll be hearing today, which is 2526, which is the one that removes the sunset on the hearings officer panel and makes it a permanent entity.
All right. Thank you. Senator Fisher? Sir, we're on Senate Bill 459. And
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Bill Fisher from District 1, Southern Oregon. And dealing with two or three situations that came up with board decisions in this interim, it seemed to me to be imperative that we strengthen the position of the hearings officer panel to a certain extent. There's always a tremendous burden upon anyone that's accused of any professional misconduct or upon someone that's not tied up with an agency in the private sector, nonprofit sector, to prove or take their case on beyond just the board investigation. And it became apparent to me that it was kind of an unfair situation where somebody had to, if they objected or felt that they had not gotten a proper treatment by a board, to have to go through a hugely expensive court situation or a hearing situation and then have the hearings officer's report basically thrown out and then have to go to the court system to get an appeal, which is hugely expensive and time consuming. So I appreciated what had been done in making the hearings officer panel separate from the agencies here in a previous session, and felt that we need to improve upon that a little bit. And that is what the impetus to draw up Senate Bill 459. In discussing it with several people, including Representative Scott, who had a little different version of a bill than mine, his would have had required that the loser pay in a court case. Mine basically took the situation and faced it with both sides having to go to court if they wish to challenge the hearings officer's decision. And in discussing it with Representative Shetterly, who had legal training, he suggested that we do it this way so that the material evidence and the findings of fact that the hearings officer found would then have to be included in any further respected in any further dealings with either a board or the court system. So that's where we're at, and I think this is a good compromise and one that will not be extremely expensive or how should I say, onerous to the boards. I wouldn't expect them necessarily to like it. It takes a bit of their freelance ability away, but basically, to me, it makes a much more fair situation. And we have had some evidence where boards have not investigated a case thoroughly, concluding without investigation that someone's employee would not maybe be a good person to interview in a particular situation of professional practice, because they would be hired by the person that was under investigation, therefore they couldn't be trusted to give good testimony or a proper testimony, because they were hired and their job hanging over their heads would cause them not to testify properly. And I don't believe that, and I don't think even if that were the case that they should be able to get by without having to investigate and check out both sides of a alleged violation of a professional practice. Sorry. So that's the history behind this, and I would ask you to support the Dash 2 amendments. And
So, Senator Fisher, if I understand correctly, your objective is to make it more difficult for a board to overturn a decision by an administrative law judge.
It would only be more difficult in that they might have to provide a higher level of evidence to get the 51% that they're supposed to have that they feel is wrong. When they can throw out the plaintiff or the person that's being investigated, when they can throw out the evidence on their side, it considerably reduces what they have to do in order to deny the hearings officer's report.
Okay, hang on. Counsel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. First of all, for the public, I am having copies of the Dash 2 amendments prepared for you and for any members of the committee that don't have those. I want to clear up a misconception. This bill is trying to address a problem where an administrative decision is made, and when it's reviewed currently, all the reviewers have to find is some evidence in the record. There's really no standard that's being applied to support the decision. And if they want to make a different decision, all they need to do, according to the proponents, is find some evidence in the record to support that alternate decision, and they can change the original decision. This bill is intended to put an evidentiary burden on the reviewing panel that they have to meet before they can change a decision, and then you get into what level of review is appropriate. Beyond a reasonable doubt is the criminal level of review. That clearly wouldn't be appropriate. Below that is clear and convincing. I think that was the original bill. This first set of amendments had by a preponderance of the evidence, which is a civil standard, and now the Dash 2s that you have in front of you have a substantial evidence in the record, which is the appropriate standard because that is the standard that's applied to other administrative type hearings like land use appeals. So it's not lowering the bar, essentially. It's putting a bar in place, and the question is what level will that bar be?
All right. Great. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I'm glad of the explanation because I don't have legal training, and it's a little difficult for me to testify and use proper terminology and all these things.
That's okay, Senator Fisher. One of the fun things about being chair of this committee is you get all the attorneys that can't agree on what the legal terms mean. It's kind of fun to watch. So,
well, without laying any blame, I would have to say that I've relied quite a little bit on Representative Shetterly's
Representative Shetterly's in the audience, so...
Well, he'll do a much better job of explaining this, I'm sure, than I did, and thank you for the opportunity.
Yeah, and, I'm sorry the rest of the committee is not here, by the way. Senator Burdick is in Portland at a board hearing for the Portland Police Fire Pension, and I believe Senator Starr has had a family emergency situation, and then the rest of the committee just left, so I don't know what's going on. Representative Shetterly, do you want to come forward and just help us with this? A little bit, because we've got a ton of agency people that hate this particular amendment or bill or whatever. So, and you're kind of on the hot sheet, because I think, wasn't the hearings panel bill originally yours, Mick?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Member of the committee. Mm-hmm. for the record, Lane Shetterly, State Representative, District 23. Yes, Mr. Chair, the hearing officer, I shouldn't say originally my idea. I think it goes back probably about 20 years before we finally adopted it in 1999. But relative to your discussion here on Senate Bill 459, one of the central compromises of House Bill 2525 dealt with the limitations under which an agency would be put with respect to modifying a hearing officer's proposed order. If you go back to 1997, when we first passed the most modern hearing officer bill, that was House Bill 2948 that the governor vetoed, the standard in that bill was what you have in the Dash 2 amendments, and that was that an agency would not be able to overturn a hearing officer's finding of fact unless there was no substantial evidence in the record to support it. So that basically if there was any evidence in the record to support the hearing officer's finding of fact, then the agency would be bound by that finding of fact, the sense being the hearing officer is the person who is in the room with the witnesses and best able to gauge credibility and to judge the demeanor and just the way to determine, to weigh the evidence. When we put House Bill 2525 together, that was through a series of compromises with the Department of Justice, the agencies, the governor's office, and we arrived at a different standard there, and that was a standard that makes it easier for hearing officers, or for agencies to redetermine the facts, and that was the preponderance of the evidence standard. And so your House Bill 459, the dash 2 amendments, would take you back to what was originally proposed in House Bill 2948, and that is the standard that is more protective of the hearing officer's findings of fact. And I don't know if you need any further explanation than that. But
I guess maybe for me, the purpose for having hearings officers, panels, ALJs, I guess there's got to be some fundamental purpose for it, and if an agency can just simply change it based on a whim, and I don't want to make a trivial comment, but it seems kind of nonsensical to have it.
Well, that's a good point, Mr. Chair, because the compromise actually went one step further. The compromise in 2525, and I'm just giving you the history here, the compromise in 2525 did give the agencies broader latitude at in modifying hearing officers' findings of fact. But then it went on to say on appeal, if the parties appeal the case to the Court of Appeals, then the Court of Appeals would review the record de novo and make their own determination of fact, which is different than applies in most administrative cases where the Court of Appeals applies its own substantial evidence test. And if there's any substantial evidence to support the agency wins. And so the balancing there was to give the agency more latitude still at the hearing level where they're reviewing the proposed order, but then on appeal from that, to give the Court of Appeals a freer hand at looking at the whole record and making its own determination of fact and not being bound by the substantial evidence test on appeal. I don't know that we've had any appeals. And I think the objection that I've heard from my conversation with Senator Fisher and Representative Scott, who also has an interest in this bill, is that, granted, you've created this... The second step of the balance is what happens on appeal, but you are still putting a party through the expense and delay of an appeal to get to that level. And so isn't it better just to bite the bullet and make that higher standard at the hearing level in limiting an agency's ability to change the findings of fact or to modify hearing officers' findings of fact? So the balance in 2525 is there. But it does take a second step to the Court of Appeals in order to really fully implement that balance that is the compromise in 2525.
All right. Great. Senator
Walker. Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Shetterly, I wasn't here in 97, but I was here in 99 and served with you on Judiciary, and I remember those hearings on 2525.
They were fun.
I don't think I'll ever forget Jenna Ingram's comments about your bill. But let me take you back, because you made reference to 1997 and House Bill 2948, and the governor vetoed it. Yet you also said that these dash twos take us back to the standard that was in 2948. So I have to ask you this question. What reason did the governor give for vetoing 2948, and did the governor veto those specific standards that you now want to implement in the dash two?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Walker. The governor's stated reasons for the veto of 2948, I think, were a couple. One was fiscal. 2948 would have created a standalone Office of Administrative Hearings, and that had fiscal impact. And so the governor's concern was the cost of creating a standalone, separate agency. There were several other features of House Bill 2948 that the governor's office and the Department of Justice and agencies objected to. And I don't believe, I think I can say with confidence, that this issue of the standard for modification of a hearing officer's findings of fact was not specifically cited in the governor's veto letter, but I think the governor's veto letter did address concerns about inroads on the authority of an agency to administer its jurisdictional responsibilities. But this issue was not specifically, I don't recall, raised as part of the veto, although I can tell you when we got to negotiating House Bill 2525 with the governor's office and the Department of Justice and the agencies, this was very much an issue.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you.
All right. Great. Representative Scott, you're sitting here. Do you want to testify? Representative Shetterly, thank you very much. You know, I think what I'll do, if you can stand by for just a minute, I'm going to do the little quick public hearing and let you talk about the hearings panel bill, the sunset,
sure.
Redeem the time while you're here. Representative Scott.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. Wayne Scott, State Representative, District 39. The issue that I have with this is just a matter of fairness. I think that the department certainly have the right to enforce the rules. I also think that they need to live by those same rules, that if they have a hearings officer that renders a decision, that they should have the same obligation that the individual has in defending it to the hearings officer, and should they prevail at the hearings officer, then I think that the department should have the same responsibility. It's very, very costly to go through a hearings officer case, number one, and number two, if you win and then get it overturned and you have to appeal it, it becomes doubly cost to take it to the Court of Appeals to attempt to prevail. I think that it would be interesting to know the number of cases that each agency has taken and either won or lost based upon appeals that they have overturned, and how many that they have lost or at the hearings officer level and then taken on to the appeals. I had a discussion with the director, and he indicates to me that there's only like 2% of them that are overturned. However, I think that's really gets to the issue. If there is 2%, and if that's the case, the standard should be just as difficult for the agency as it is for the individual. So that's my interest in the bill.
All right. Thank you. Any questions, Representative Scott? Thank you very much
Thank
for
very
coming
much.
Over. Appreciate your time. And see, everybody else here is an agency person. They can all come back later. So we're going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 459, open the public hearing on Senate Bill 2526. Representative Shetterly.
Mm-hmm. That's the only amendment I have today. I don't know why.
So tell us why this is a wonderful bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Before I sit down, do you have the dash A4s, the dash A3s, and the dash 1s?
We just have the dash A4s.
Okay, so I think you need to distribute.
Yes, sir.
You said 2526?
Yes.
Thank you.
Do you have that one?
Yes, sir.
It is.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Lane Shetterly, State Representative, District 23, here in support of House Bill 2526 that repeals the sunset on the hearing officer panel and makes a few other smaller changes to it. I'm pleased to report to you that this bill passed the House, I think, by a vote of 57-0 just a couple of weeks ago, and so has strong support, and I'm pleased to see also has good bipartisan sponsorship on this side with Senators Beyer and Senator Courtney. You've had discussion about the hearing officer panel, and so I'm not sure if I need to go back into that exactly, except to say that when we established the hearing officer panel in House Bill 2525 back in 1999, one of the elements of the compromise would be that it would be a pilot project with a sunset in it, and we would see how it worked. Tom Ewing is here today and can tell you in his capacity as chief hearing officer about the workings of the panel. It was reviewed by the Joint Legislative Audit Committee last year, even in the throes of the special sessions, and I've excerpted part of their review and attached it to the testimony that I have distributed to you, where among other things, the Joint Legislative Audit Committee recommends that the sunset be repealed and that the panel be made permanent. I've also attached for your reading pleasure an excerpt from a Willamette Law Review article by David Hendricks. David was the drafter and legislative counsel that worked with us through the long and laborious negotiation and drafting process that brought us House Bill 2525, that has written an excellent history of it. And for those of you who need to be refreshed on the history of House Bill 2525 and some of the policy underpinnings of the hearing officer panel, I would commend that article to you. It really is well done. And I'm pleased to have the history of the panel so well represented in the legal literature. I will take you through a couple of things that House Bill 2526 does besides remove the sunset. My summary of the testimony that is before you indicates, too, that we've changed in this bill the title of the Chief Hearing Officer to Chief Administrative Law Judge, and we've changed the title Hearing Officer to the name of the panel from Hearing Officer Panel to Office of Administrative Hearings, and we changed the title of Hearing Officer to Administrative Law Judge. Already in state government, we have ALJs, Administrative Law Judges, in the PUC and Workers' Compensation Divisions. They perform essentially the same function in those agencies, and so the change here in that respect is to harmonize the title of these hearing officers with those that are in other branches of state government. And also in federal government, you have hearing officers who go by the title Administrative Law Judge, and on a national basis, it is the common title. And so we are aligning ourselves with other branches or other agencies of the state by making this change, and also then aligning ourselves with the title nationally. This bill maintains the hearing officer panel in the employment department. That was one of the grand compromises, too, with House Bill 2525, that instead of creating a standalone hearing officer panel, we would attach it to the employment department. And I am pleased to say that aspect of the compromise has worked very well. The employment department, especially under Debbie Lincoln, the current director, has been very supportive of the panel and has worked with us in the hearing officer panel oversight committee in recommending the changes that are reflected in House Bill 2526. One of those changes, and again maintaining this balance of within an agency but still trying to maintain some operational independence from the agency. This bill does a couple of things. It provides that the director of the agency will still have the appointing authority for the chief administrative law judge, but will consult with the oversight committee. The oversight committee consists of two representatives from the House, two members from the Senate, two members from the Department of Justice, and two members of the public. And so she has agreed that she, with the retaining the appointing authority for the chief ALJ, she would do that in consultation with the oversight committee. And the bill also provides for the appointment of the chief administrative law judge for a term of 4 years, making it different than other section heads within the Department of Employment, giving some independence there with this term appointment. And providing that the appointment is terminable during that four-year term for cause, basically as outlined in the bill. The bill also authorizes the chief administrative law judge to employ student law clerks on a temporary basis to assist in research. That's essentially a cost savings function, so that student law clerks can work can do the research work in support of the hearing officers. We have a dash A4 amendment that makes clear at the request of Mary Botkin that the student, I'm sorry, let's see, oh, that's it's the A3 amendments that say that the student law clerks will not act as hearing officers or conduct hearings. That is perfectly agreeable. That was not the intent. The dash A4 amendments address a technical amendment that was requested, I think, by Department of Justice and Child Support Division. They apparently have a lot of forms that they need to work through, and their forms still say hearing officer panel and will for some time until they work out all their forms. And so this A4 amendment acknowledges that if the bill goes forward with the change in the title of the panel to Office of Administrative Hearings, that references to hearing officer panel in other documents would still be considered permissible until those documents are cycled through, so that agencies don't have to go out and print a bunch of new forms. That's fine. That keeps costs down. I have also distributed to you what were the dash one amendments on the House side. Those were supposed to get in on the House. They did not because the amendments were not delivered to the committee the day the committee was in work session. I've conceptually amended those to coordinate with the pagination of the A engrossed bill, and the dash one amendments as presented to you clarify that the Wage and Hour Commission and the State Apprenticeship and Training Council are not agencies or boards within the panel. That is just clarification because both of those are under the Bureau of Labor and Industries, and BOLI is already exempt as an agency. And so this just clarifies that these particular, the commission and council that are under BOLI are also exempt. So there's no change there. That's clarification. One of the agreements among all of the participants that in putting House Bill 2526 together was that we would basically maintain status quo in the agencies that are in and the agencies that are out. That the most important thing this session is to make the panel permanent and continue this grand experiment. The last thing I would say just is addressing House Bill 4035 from Special Session 5. That was the bill that extended the sunset on the panel just to June 30 of 2005. That bill directed that certain questions about the panel continue to be examined. They are set forth on the third page of the JLAC audit report that I am giving you. And what I would, what I've committed to the chair and what I will commit to the committee, as I did in the House, is that the questions about the continued operation and fine-tuning and the making better of the panel will continue to be questions that the Hearing Officer Panel Oversight Committee will undertake as part of its ongoing review of the panel to continue to make recommendations back to the legislature. So that we don't just put this panel away and forget about it. We will maintain the Oversight Committee, and the Oversight Committee, working with the Employment Department and to the extent necessary, JLAC, will continue that review. I'll stop there.
Hang on a second. Mm-hmm. Need a little work session. Senate Bill 2526, if I could get the consent of the committee to adopt the dash one amendments.
So the dash one amendments, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Ferrioli moves the adoption of the dash one amendments. Is there any objection or discussion? No discussion, no objection. This motion passes. And how about the A3 amendments?
Mr. Chairman, move the A3 amendments.
Senator Ferrioli moves the adoption of the A3 amendments. Discussion? Any objections? Hearing none, in order. And now the A4 amendments.
Chairman, move the A4 amendments.
Senator Ferrioli now moves the adoption of the A4 amendments. Is there any discussion? Any objection? Hearing none, so ordered. So those amendments have been adopted, and there are no other amendments that we're aware of.
There are no other amendments, Mr. Chair.
And could you just enlighten me what the issue is with respect to why some agencies are out and why others are in?
Well, that was part of the grand compromise, too. If you look on page 4 of the bill...
I'm looking for rationale.
No, yeah, I can give you the rationale for... There are two main rationale, I think.
Okay.
One was that we left out independently elected officials and their offices. That's why you see Department of Justice, the Governor's Office, Secretary of State, the Labor Commissioner. Those are out. And then those boards and commissions under those offices. Department of Revenue is out because, of course, it has its own tax magistrate's division, so it operates separately, as does the Workers' Compensation Board, for instance. You've got your own system of workers' comp appeals. And then you know, you can look at these. For instance, Department of Corrections is not in. We didn't want to be burdening the hearing officer panel hearing cases why prisoners were receiving chunky peanut butter instead of creamy peanut butter. I think the panel is hearing over 35,000 cases already. That was a workload issue. And some of these, frankly, Mr. Chair, are just weird. PUC, the last thing we wanted to do was burden the panel, especially a brand new panel, with PUC rate cases and the kind of work that PUC gets involved in. LUBA, again, a system that already had its own well-established system of appeals. And so I don't want to say that there was no rationale. There were several rationalia or something like that. But it's interesting, if you compare 2948 in 1997 with 2525, House Bill 2948 took the opposite approach, that said that we are going to identify a certain stable of agencies, and I think there were probably only about 13 or 14 agencies and boards and commissions that were actually included in 2948. When the governor took this on, he said, no, let's turn this upside down and say everybody's in except those that we specifically exempt. And so actually with 2525, you still have a much broader inclusion of agencies and boards and commissions than we would have had under 2948. Tom can probably give you the total number, but that gives you a sense of why some of those are out.
All right. Does the committee have any concerns regarding this bill and the adoption of amendments, or?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Walker.
I remember this quite clearly from the 99 session. I was very involved in the hearings, and this panel has actually done well. I've reviewed the audit report. I've appreciated hearing from Representative Shetterly how it's been working. Unless there's any opposition, I think the state of Oregon has really saved a significant amount of money and streamlined its processes with this panel, and I'd be in support of continuing.
All right, Mr. Ewing, you don't need to testify unless you really feel compelled to.
Darn, I prepared.
It's okay.
Okay. Yeah. You can have your bill.
I'm going to stop.
I was just teasing.
Have your bill and talk ad nauseum. Okay. Does anybody want to move the bill to the floor of the Senate this time?
Yeah, could you?
Yeah. Senator Walker.
I would move House Bill 2526 as amended today to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Walker now moves House Bill 2526 as amended to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objections? Hearing none.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
And
thank you.
I will carry the bill. All right. And that's to keep you from getting ahead of Senator.
I just wondered about that.
All right. If I could get the committee's indulgence for just a minute. We'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 216. We have one person signed up, Jeanette Pullman. And, Council, if you'll tell us what 216 does.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Senate Bill 216 establishes a contested case proceeding to resolve disputes where there is unclaimed property. Broadens DSL's ability to utilize or the methods that DSL can utilize in disposing of such property. I think that's about it. Makes other conforming definitions with regard to financial institutions.
Come up and tell us why this is necessary.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Jeanette Holman, Assistant Director for the Division of State Lands. Senate Bill 216 is primarily a housekeeping measure, in our opinion. The changes recommended in here were uncovered in the process of reviewing and revising our entire trust property program during the last biennium. Some of the recommendations came from the Secretary of State in an audit that they performed at our request. Some of the recommendations came from Legislative Council as we were working on the legislation, and some came in the process of revamping our rules on this program at the request of the Bankers Association. I can go through them section by section or however you'd like.
That's fine. Committee, where are you on this?
Fine.
Any heartburn? You want to take more time, or are you?
No.
I think it's fine.
Okay.
I'm fine with it. Mr.
Do a work
Chair.
Session. Senate Bill 216. Senator Walker.
I move. We don't have any amendments.
No amendments.
216. I move Senate Bill 216 unamended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
All right. Senator Walker now moves Senate Bill 216 unamended to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? No discussion. Motion passes. Senator Walker, you want to carry that one?
Sure.
All right, thank you very much. Let me see. You've got an appointment at 10:15.
Right? I do.
Anybody in here who cannot come back on 4:59 future time? Okay. With that, I think we're just going to go ahead and adjourn. Thank you.